Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what is happening in Ohio, the key swing state, where the president canceled last-minute rallies to deal with the devastation caused by the superstorm Sandy. An expert on election law, Daniel Takagi, a professor of law at Ohio State University's College of Law, joins us to discuss whether there will be a repeat of the close election in 2004, which many Democrats feel was stolen by the Republicans who remain in control of the state's election apparatus. Then we'll speak with meteorologist Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University and author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. We will discuss the politics of global warming denial in the present electoral environment and the reality of climate change that will impact the politics of the future. Then finally, we'll look into the staggering and growing cost of this latest storm with Mike Tidwell, the director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and the author of The Ravaging Tide, a book about global warming and hurricanes. He has an article at The Nation, "We Are All From New Orleans Now." We will discuss the extent to which insurance companies are recognizing the growing threat of climate change and whether they will weigh in against the global warming denial campaign financed by oil and coal companies who have the Republican Party and a lot of coal and oil state Democrats in their pockets. Joining us now is Daniel Takagi, who is professor of law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law and senior fellow of election law at Moritz. His area of expertise includes election law, civil rights, and federal courts, and he is the co-author of the casebook Election Law, Cases and Materials. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Takagi.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And yesterday, Daniel, I spoke with a writer, an investigative reporter with The Nation, who made the case that even though the Democrats keep saying they have a strong ground game in Ohio, which is a must-win state, certainly for Romney, and it would be pretty next to impossible for Obama to win the presidency if he didn't win it. So, you know, it's undoubtedly the key swing state, and he was arguing that the Republican ground game is hidden, even if Obama has 131 field offices to Romney's 40 in Ohio. What you have to factor in is how much the Republican Party has outsourced what political parties used to do in terms of people manning phone banks, knocking on doors, etc., and that these are being outsourced by these wealthy oligarchs that have supported the Republican Party through these super PACs, where they remain anonymous. And because of Citizens United, corporate CEOs can urge their employees to vote, and the extent to which they support, for example, offering up cars to take people to the polls to make sure that their employees vote for Romney, etc., this is not being counted. You're on the ground in Ohio. What are you seeing?
Well, I think it is very hard to tell exactly how strong each side's ground game is in Ohio and other key swing states, in part for the reason you mentioned, that a lot of it is coming, a lot of the spending, that is, for get-out-the-vote efforts and other things designed to increase each side's share of the vote, is coming not just from the campaigns, not just from the parties, but by outside groups, and that includes super PACs as well as nonprofit organizations. There's a report just out today showing that we've got $840 million in disclosed spending from these outside groups in the current election cycle, and about 70% of that spending is from conservative groups, less than 30% of it from progressive Democratic-aligned groups. So, yeah, I think it's fair to say that there is a significant funding edge on the part of conservative outside groups as opposed to Democratic-leaning ones, and that does make it harder to tell. Now, having said that, I mean, I do think that the Obama campaign has a really strong ground game in Ohio and other states, and that's something that they're counting on. They have for the past several weeks here, in fact, been making a strong push to urge people to make use of early voting, which in Ohio starts 35 days before the election. But I think everyone knows that this is going to be a very, very close election, that, as you mentioned at the outset, it's going to be practically impossible to win the White House without winning Ohio. And we have to wait and see. It's certainly conceivable, given the large number of provisional ballots that are certain to be cast in Ohio, that we won't know the result of the presidential election on election night if it all comes down to our state again.
Well, of course, it all came down to your state in 2004, and I don't think it's too hyperbolic or even in any way inaccurate to say that the 2004 election was stolen by the Republicans, particularly with the collusion between Karl Rove and the Republican Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell. There seems to be so much evidence out there that even though people don't like to use the word stolen and everybody sort of equivocates about these things, I remember at the time the vice presidential candidate on the Democratic side, Edwards, didn't want to concede. That I talked to people who worked on that campaign for Kerry and Edwards on the ground there, and they said they knew that they won, and the last minute they lost. The incoming Secretary of State, who was a Democrat, made an early trip to Blackwell's office, only to find them furiously shredding documents, tons of documents. I mean, there's no point to go on because I know this has been looked at a lot.
I guess I would say I would take a slightly different position. I think it is a bit hyperbolic. I mean, I was quite critical, as you may recall, of Secretary of State Blackwell at the time for many of his decisions. But all that said, the margin was well over 100,000 votes. And even if you take into account the dubious decisions he made during that election, I mean, it was a close election, but it wasn't that close. This wasn't like Florida 2000 close. And I don't think that those decisions were enough to swing the result. But this is all water under the bridge that's probably not worth going over again at this stage.
Sure. Well, if you combine that with the fact that that Kerry was ahead in, I think, of all of the swing states in terms of exit polls, and that mystery remains because the decision was after he suddenly was ahead in all in nine states, and then he ended up losing eight out of the nine in spite of what the exit polls
Which suggests that there was something, unless you could plan a vast conspiracy among the states, that strongly suggests that there was something wrong with the exit poll methodologies, as a lot of people concluded after.
Right.
I don't know how helpful it is to rehash the details, but I think there are real concerns about this election. We again have a Republican Secretary of State now who has made some questionable decisions, of which I and others have been critical, especially decisions having to do with early voting. Fortunately, he was reversed by the courts on that, and provisional voting as well, where there is still litigation going on. And as I mentioned earlier, we're likely to have a lot of provisional votes in this state. I mean, only California and New York have more than Ohio, and we're likely to have a good 200,000 provisional ballots cast in this election. Somewhere around 80% of those will be counted, and that means there could be 160,000 or so votes on election night that have not yet been counted but will ultimately be counted.
So rather than continue with hyperbole, let's deal with some of the other hyperbole, because nobody, as far as I can tell, on the Democratic side, and you have to assume that they want to win, there's no reason to think that they want to lose, nobody that I've spoken to seems to think that there's much substance to this constant story that you hear, that the electronic voting machines are owned by a company that's controlled by Mitt Romney's son, Tag, and therefore they're going to just with a little bit of electronic magic, they're going to suddenly switch the results to Romney. What's your understanding of that story?
I think that is a non-issue, and that's not to deny that there are serious problems with all of the voting systems we use, to be honest, in terms of testing, in terms of the reliability of the software, and frankly, in terms of the procedures that are used across the country. That said, the story about Hart InterCivic, which, you know, I believe that's the company that that one of Romney's sons has a significant share in. Their voting systems are used in two of our 88 counties. I think they're the number three player by a significant margin in the election. And honestly, I find this to be something of a conspiracy theory. It's sometimes difficult to tell what are the real problems and to separate those from the ones that are more histrionic concerns raised by people who are worried about something that's a very remote possibility. But I would put that story into the latter category.
Well, but it has the effect, surely, of depressing the vote. It certainly depresses the enthusiasm to vote. If you believe,
I would take issue with that. I think there is plenty of enthusiasm, at least in the relatively few states where you have a competitive election, to vote, and there really are very few people who actually believe these conspiracy theories in the grand scheme of things. Mm-hmm.
Well, but I'm saying those that propagate them have the effect of suggesting that the game is rigged, and therefore you shouldn't bother to enter the game. So
yeah,
it's not particularly helpful.
I think you're right. If they were believed on a widespread basis, I think they could conceivably have that effect. But honestly, I don't really think too many people believe these conspiracy theories. But I think your bigger point is correct, which is that it really doesn't serve too many people's interests, other than perhaps that of Karl Rove to propagate them.
So, again, I'm speaking with Daniel Takagi, who is a professor of law at The Ohio State University's Moritz School of College of Law and a senior fellow of election law at Moritz. And his area of expertise includes election law, civil rights, and federal courts. And he's the co-author of the casebook, Election Law, Cases and Materials. So the president has canceled these last-minute appearances in Ohio, and because of the devastation from the storm Sandy, and he's directing FEMA, et cetera, and being a president, I guess. Maybe it's probably better for him in terms of his situation in the polls. I had recently had Nate Silver on, who does 538. Mm-hmm. He still maintains that Obama is going to win Ohio. But boy, the polls are all over the place, and most of them indicate a swing towards Romney, and that he's ahead in most of the polls. And you know, that's not just the Republican leaning polls, Rasmussen, Gallup, and others as well. So, are you following this, or are you trying to follow this?
I follow the polls very closely, and I think Silver's blog rates, last I check, Obama is having roughly a 72-73% chance of winning overall, and about the same within Ohio, about a 72% chance of winning. And you know, there are various other metrics that are used. I think most of them show that Obama still has a slight edge, but it is certainly close enough that we shouldn't be surprised if the election comes out the other way. I don't think there's any question that Romney got a significant bounce after the first debate, nor is there much question that bounce to some extent dissipated after the second and third debates. But it is certainly close enough that it could go either way in Ohio and in the Electoral College.
So what's your sense then? I know you're not a pollster. You're a specialist on election law. But the last-minute effort on the part of Romney, and they've actually had more time because of the storm. They canceled campaigning in Virginia to do extra campaigning in Ohio, and now they've seized on the idea that they were right about the auto bailout. I don't quite know how that's playing. There's also this factory that Bain Capital owned that they're going to move to China. That's become a focus of a lot of activity in, I believe that's actually in Illinois, but it, presumably it kind of, echoes across the borders there. What's your sense of how the Romney's last minute argument is playing?
I think it's hard to tell, but it's clearly been a handicap to Romney throughout this campaign, especially his op-ed in the New York Times, "Let Detroit Go Bankrupt," it was titled, and that's hurt him not only in Michigan, as just about everyone knows, where Obama's got a significant advantage, but also in Ohio, right? What people may not realize is that much of northern Ohio, especially around the Toledo area, is heavily dependent on the American automobile industry. So when Romney wrote, "Let Detroit go bankrupt," he might as well have been saying, "Let Northwest Ohio go bankrupt," at least in many people's minds. And that's hurt him a lot. Now he's got his recent comments regarding Jeep possibly shipping jobs to China, which has been denied by Jeep. I can't imagine that that line of attack from Romney is going to play too well in northern Ohio, but I suppose we may find out in just 7 days from now.
Well, I thought it was interesting, Daniel Takagi, that the CEO of Chrysler, in charge of the Jeep, mm-hmm. Who's in many ways engineered Chrysler's comeback, along with federal help, of course,
right.
His dismissal of what Romney said was quite stinging for a businessman.
It was an emphatic denial that Jeep has any plans, Fiat Jeep has any plans to get rid of their operations in Northwest Ohio around the Toledo area, which seems to take the bite out of the attack and the ad that the Romney campaign has been running. But I guess we'll see.
Well, but he referred to it as fantasies, and he was quite contemptuous of it. So your sense is then, just in closing, that you think that Nate Silver's right. He's sticking to his guns here. Everywhere else it seems to be turning against, if you're to believe the polls. Colorado's turning against Obama. I mean,
I think if you actually study carefully the polls here and in other states like Colorado, it's been really close since the days after the first debate, and it continues to be close. I think that Obama probably has a slight advantage, but I'm having read Nate Silver's blog, as he'd concede, it's distinctly possible that Romney will win Ohio, that he'll win Colorado, and that he'll win the election, even though he has Obama as a slight favorite. And I think the consensus of opinion among those who study the polls carefully is that Obama seems to have a slight edge, but it is close enough that it could easily go either way.
And then the ultimate irony would be a deadlock to either one, that Obama wins the Electoral College and is behind in the popular vote, or two, the Electoral College is tied, in which case you would end up with Romney, if he wins the popular vote, having Biden, right, as his vice president? Is that?
Yeah, and I think these are very unlikely scenarios. I mean, it's slightly more likely that we could have, as happened in 2000, the popular vote come out one way, most likely in favor of Romney, and the Electoral College the other, most likely in favor of Obama. I mean, that's a possibility. It is also quite possible, as I mentioned earlier, that the election could come down to a single state or a couple of states that are too close to call on election night, whether because of disputes over provisional ballots or absentee ballots or something like that. So, I think the odds are against it, but it is, again, possible that we could be in for another protracted post-election controversy. It is that close, in contrast to 4 years ago.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Daniel Takagi.
Thanks for having me in.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Takagi, who is a professor of law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law and senior fellow of election law at Moritz. His area of expertise includes election law, civil rights, and federal courts, and he's co-author of the casebook Election Law Cases and Materials. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the politics of global warming denial.
Oh, it won't happen twice, my friend. And I know because I know it, child. It cannot happen again.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone. An actor out on loan. Riders on the storm.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Dispatches from the Front Lines. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
And let's explain the hockey stick, because I'm sure people are wondering about the title of your book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. The hockey stick is a chart that you came up with along with others on the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and it shows it goes back a thousand years. So you have the long, flat stick part of it, a thousand years, and then just in the 20th century, it suddenly turns upward with global warming.
Yeah, well, it was the first attempt more than a decade ago to try to piece together the information from indirect information from archives, natural archives, like tree rings and corals and ice cores, to extend the temperature record farther back in time, because we only have about a century of widespread thermometer measurements. And what this reconstruction yielded was a long-term trend that showed relatively warm conditions about 1,000 years ago, cooling in subsequent centuries as we head into the Little Ice Age of the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. And you can think of that, if you like, as the handle of a hockey stick. It sort of resembles that. And then there's the abrupt warming of the past century, which exceeds any level of warmth that's seen in the record as far back as it goes. And so this was one early attempt to extend the temperature record that yielded the conclusion that the recent warming really is unprecedented as far back as we can go, more than 1,000 years. And now there are many other similar efforts that have been done to extend the record back in time. And they've all yielded basically that same answer, that the recent warming really does look unprecedented as far back as we can go, about 1,000 years.
But as real as the evidence that you and 99% of global scientists have come up with, and the very manifestations of these extreme weather events that are happening more frequently and with greater intensity, nevertheless, we have global warming denial. And as I mentioned in the opening, the oil and coal companies have pretty much got the entire Republican Party in their pocket, along with a lot of oil and coal state Democrats. So,
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And my book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, is as much about that as it is about the science. It's also about my personal experience when we published this iconic graph more than a decade ago. It sort of found itself in the crosshairs of efforts to discredit the science of climate change. Our detractors cynically believed that if they could take down this hockey stick and take down, through in essence by discrediting us and our work, they could argue that they had undermined the entire case for accepting the reality of human-caused climate change. Of course, that's hardly true. There are many independent lines of evidence that all tell us that we are warming the planet and changing the climate, and that if we continue to proceed with business as usual, fossil fuel burning and increasing our greenhouse gas emissions, that we will see much larger and more dangerous changes in the future. So we really found ourselves sort of at the center of the larger debate over climate change and what to do about it. And our detractors, rather than engaging in that worthy debate that is to be had about what to do about the problem, have simply tried to avoid even having that debate by pretending the problem doesn't exist.
Well, but isn't that in part due to the uselessness of our press? I mean, in the sense that our press has voluntarily shackled itself with this binary notion of for every argument, there's an equal and opposite argument. This idea that in the universe of discourse, there are only two black and white positions, and that this has enabled, for example, creationists and those that deny evolution to argue that they are just the other side of evolution, and equally true that global warming deniers are given equal billing as the global warming scientists by the press.
Yeah, I think that's right, that the press does in part bear some of the responsibility for this. Of course, there are very good journalists. There are some great science and environmental journalists that are still out there, but there are far fewer of them. One of the problems is that over the past decade, we've seen massive layoffs in the journalism industry of technology and science journalists. CNN, some years ago, fired their entire science and technology team. The Weather Channel got rid of their climate science division. And what's happened is, as these, as we've lost traditional science and environmental journalists, the stories that used to be covered by them, by these journalists who had the training and the background necessary to determine, who's right and who's wrong, they've been replaced in general by, political journalists who are more than likely to treat a problem, a debate over science, of matters of science, as if it's just another political debate where there are two equal sides. And of course, we know that in science, that isn't the case. We don't every time, NASA announces the discovery of a new exoplanet or some other exciting space discovery, we don't have a representative from the Flat Earth Society there to debate them about it. And yet when it comes to issues like climate science, that is essentially the way many in the media do treat it, as if we should give anti-science an equal stage with science. And it's just not right. But unfortunately, it is one of the, I think it's one of the unfortunate consequences of some of the changes we've seen, the larger scale changes in our media in recent years.
Again, I'm speaking with meteorologist Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's the co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org, and in 2007 he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Well, the reason, though, this is key to our discussion, Michael Mann, is that the president and his challenger Mitt Romney have not mentioned climate change. The president did in an interview with MTV, so they're not speaking about it, but it's speaking to us. And you see all these pictures on television. You see the press that we're talking about is devoting all of this coverage, but they're very, very afraid to actually put context in this coverage about what's behind what is happening, and that is to do with this protracted assault And then going back to the East Anglia hacking, we still to this day don't know who that was behind that Russian server that hacked into those email accounts and created this phony crisis and which the conservatives and the Rupert Murdoch press and others have run with.
Well, that's right, and in fact, it was the Murdoch media empire, along with various news organizations or pseudo news organizations that are actually funded by the Koch brothers and other ideological right-leaning special interests. They did, in fact, manufacture this fake scandal, and not coincidentally, in the lead-up to the Copenhagen summit a couple years ago. And the intention was very obvious. It was to try to muddy the waters, to confuse the public and policymakers, and essentially scuttle any possible progress in dealing with this problem at that critical moment. It was, again, a very deeply cynical assault on science with a very clear intention to do whatever was necessary to prevent us from making the tough decisions that we need to make, moving away from fossil fuel energy, turning towards non-carbon-based sources of energy, which aren't destroying the climate and destroying the planet. Unfortunately, there are some very powerful vested interests who don't want to see us undergo that transition, and they fought tooth and nail to discredit the science, to fund front groups, and even so-called experts who are willing to attack the science, to pressure policymakers, to even pressure media organizations to present their anti-scientific views about the problem as if they are on a par with what the scientific community has to say.
So since you've been engaged in these climate wars for some time, Michael Mann, and your book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines, chronicles them. How much is this current Sandy storm, and it's followed with following Irene, and then Hurricane Katrina, and all of these accumulated losses, along with the tsunami and nuclear meltdown in Japan that cost insurance companies over $40 billion. The figures are becoming staggering. So the assumption is here that the insurance companies at some point or other are going to say, global warming is real because it's going to put us out of business. Do you think their clout is going to give your side some of the kind of heft that it needs, given that the oil companies and the coal companies are pouring money into denial and they've essentially bought the Republican Party, as I mentioned earlier?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think fortunately, there are, other powerful vested interests who stand to lose out big time from climate change. And not just the insurance industry, but the ones who really lose out are the ones who insure the insurance industry, the reinsurance industry, Swiss Re, Munich Re, some of these large reinsurance companies that have to pay out very large losses when you have a natural disaster like what just took place with Sandy. And for the first time, last year we had I believe it was a record 11 different $1 billion or greater cost climate and weather related disasters. And the reinsurance industry has taken a hard look at the data, they've taken a hard look at the science, and they've said they are losing out because of climate change. Climate change is leading to increased weather and climate-related losses. And so, fortunately, big business isn't necessarily monolithic when it comes to this issue. And in the case of the reinsurance industry, they're a natural ally in making sure that we follow what the science has to say and that we recognize that there are very real costs in not taking action to avoid, a potential catastrophe down the line if we don't reduce our greenhouse gas emissions.
So when would you predict, Michael Mann, that we'll have adult conversations that are anchored in reality in our political debates here in the United States? As I mentioned as I mentioned, the leading politicians now running for president have managed to try and sidestep this issue. And of course, you know, maybe in the next few days, Obama, because he's trying to take charge through FEMA of this catastrophe,
right.
It seems like an opportunity for him to start to get real. I think most of the public recognize something's going on. You'd have to be living on another planet not to notice that.
Yeah, I think this was a critical event. You know, we don't yet know how critical it was, in the sense that sometimes it takes a little bit of time before we can really assess the fallout of a disaster of this sort. But, you know, it's worth keeping in mind that it was a single catastrophic event. It was the Cuyahoga River fires back in the 1970s. The fact that this river caught on fire, that awakened the public to the fact that there was a very real threat to ongoing, you know, pollution of our waterways, of our streams and rivers, and allowing, you know, polluters to just dump toxic waste into our waterways. So it was a single galvanizing event that really helped reshape the whole debate over, you know, clean water. And it may be it'll be something like Sandy, and maybe Sandy was it, because it had all the hallmarks. You know, we can't say, obviously, that climate change caused Sandy. What we can say is that Sandy, you know, strengthened, and it took place within an environment that was certainly made more favorable by climate change. The record tidal surge in New York City, where we broke the all-time record that extends nearly two centuries back in time, 13 feet at Battery Park. Well, one of those 13 feet was sea level rise, okay, because sea level has already risen a foot in that part of the world. And so we know that part of that surge had as an underlying aggravating factor global sea level rise. We also know that that storm formed over near record sea surface temperatures off the east coast of the U.S. So it had more energy and it had more water vapor within it, which you take water vapor, you carry it up in the middle of a hurricane and you turn it into rain. And the more water vapor in that storm, the more potential there is for flooding rains. We saw that a year ago with Hurricane Irene, where we had record flooding in New England. And in part, that was related to the fact that that storm formed over warmer waters. It had more moisture and more moisture to turn into flooding rainfall. So, you know, we are seeing the if you like, the loading of the weather dice, which is to say every individual meteorological event has a randomness to it. There's a random component of weather. But what we're seeing is a systematic tendency towards more extreme events of this sort. We're seeing the loading of those weather dice towards more disastrous events.
Well, Michael Mann, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with meteorologist Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website, realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Internet Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking with the author of an article, We Are All From New Orleans Now.
Now we're fighting wars over oil and gas. No matter who wins, it will not last. The earth is scarred, the planet is warming. Don't you think that all of it's a great big warning?
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia?
There's been a crash on the levee and mama, you've been refused. Well, it's king for king and it's queen for queen. It's gonna be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Oh, mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to find yourself.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Tidwell, who is the director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and the author of the book The Ravaging Tide, which is about global warming and hurricanes. And of course, you've just experienced one. It made landfall a little, I guess, to the north of you on the Jersey Shore. But presumably, you experienced it there in the Chesapeake.
Yes, it was a big hurricane, very big. Here in the D.C. area, for 36 hours, it sounded like a train in the distance. I mean, there was so much wind, so much roaring of wind, but the worst of it was to the north of us. It was just a massive storm, as you know, 1,000-mile diameter for the wind field, lowest barometric pressure of any hurricane to come onshore in the United States that far north. It was a monster.
So you've been at it for a while here in terms of trying to get public awareness to the problem of global warming, and you've written the book The Ravaging Tide, which is about global warming and hurricanes. And I'm curious to know how much, in terms of the climate wars, the insurance companies are going to, since they've got skin in the game, whether they're going to get more politically active. We know that on the global warming denial side, you have the oil companies and the coal companies, and they effectively have the Republican Party in their pocket and a lot of coal and oil state Democrats as well. But, you know, insurance companies have got considerable resources too. So what's your sense of how this battle is going to play out long term? Because, you know, you got politicians today denying the reality of global warming, but, they can't keep denying it because the reality is just going to keep coming back and biting us.
Well, you know, speaking of politicians and climate change, during the presidential debates, neither candidate, Romney or Obama, spoke about climate change. And unfortunately for them, I guess, the climate decided to speak to them. And I think that that's what we've seen with Sandy. The fingerprints of global warming are all over this storm. I mean, it is unusual for hurricanes to strike the United States, even in Florida, this late in October, much less this far north. It's just, it's the weather equivalent of like snow in Saudi Arabia, what we've just seen with this hurricane almost on the eve of November, striking New Jersey. Sea surface temperatures in the North Atlantic of 5 degrees above normal. We could just go on and on. And climate scientists tell us this is precisely the kind of storm, and if it's precisely in the pattern of climate change that we've seen recently. The insurance companies are being more vocal. What's really tragic about the insurance companies, however, is they've been more and more sounding the alarm about climate change is happening, extreme weather is increasing. My home in Tacoma Park, Maryland, is insured by Travelers, and I got a flyer a month ago. I got a letter with this flyer on it showing a house about to be hit by a tornado and with storm clouds over the top. And Travelers sent this to me by way of telling me that my policy premium was going up because of extreme weather. And then in the fine print at the bottom, they cited scientific studies saying that the extreme weather was driven by global warming. The tragic thing about the insurance companies, yes, they have skin in the game. Yes, they're affected by this extreme weather, but they're reluctant, very reluctant to say what's causing it. And that's because the insurance companies, they don't make their money off premiums. That's not how they make most of their money. They make their money by investing your premiums in the stock market and making money that way. And they invest a lot in fossil fuels. So you have this conspiracy of silence almost among insurance companies as to the why of global warming. But they are getting more and more noisy about the what. And that alone, just the insurance company sounding the alarm that extreme weather is increasing should be enough to move us further down the path of solutions.
So insurance, of course, is a state matter controlled by state regulators. Do you think, though, that we could get to a situation, because the Travelers pamphlet that you referred to, Mike Tidwell, the data was compiled by the German reinsurance giant Munich Re, and they have a scientific footnote to it saying that in all likelihood, we have to regard this finding as an initial climate change footprint in our U.S. loss data from the past four decades. Previously, there has not been such a strong chain of evidence. So you say correctly that in the bottom of the fly that you got from travelers, they acknowledged climate change and the reality of climate change. I'm just wondering what will happen, though, when you got politically appointed state insurance officials and insurance companies going to them and saying, we've got to increase our premiums because of global warming. And these politically appointed state insurance officials, particularly in the red states, will be saying, no, global warming doesn't exist. It's a fraud. So what happens then? I mean, I know it's not necessarily your expertise, but I'm just curious about how this argument is going to pan out in the future.
First of all, the U.S. insurance industry and likely the global insurance industry will not survive in its present form under climate change. There's almost no way that it will. The extreme weather is continuing. The losses pile up. I mean, this Hurricane Sandy alone is probably going to be about $50 billion in total losses, if not more. These things are just going to accelerate. There's going to come a point where the insurance industry is going to recognize that they cannot survive unless there is a stabilization of the climate, unless we switch to clean energy and off of coal, oil, and natural gas fast enough to slow down these extreme weather events. That moment is going to come. I predict that it's going to come pretty soon. And when the insurance companies finally get political, finally put their shoulder into sounding the alarm, I think that we may have a narrow window of time where we could still pull off a sort of global climate stabilization, because they are very powerful, and they may find resistance from Republicans, but there's just going to come a point where Travelers Insurance is pointing to ExxonMobil and saying, you're putting us out of business. You know, Travelers is going to point to Peabody Coal and say, you are killing our shareholders. And that's just going to happen. Big Ag is going to do the same thing. I mean, the major wheat and corn growers in the Midwest are going to start pointing to the coal industry and saying, you're killing our business. It's taken so long to get to that point, you wonder if we still have enough time.
So, Mike Tidwell is the director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and the author of the book, The Ravaging Tide, which is about global warming and hurricanes. And we're talking about the cost of this storm, this superstorm Sandy, that's by no means over. The estimates are as high as $50 billion in costs. This follows Irene, which had $10 billion in insurance losses. And then you go back to Katrina, which had some $500 billion in insured losses. $125 billion in losses. And then the nuclear meltdown in Japan recently, I believe that was up to $40 billion in losses. You just begin to sort of wonder how, you know, these losses are coming more frequently, how the system can cope with it.
Yes, and one of the things that, you know, I write in an article I did for The Nation magazine this week, I point out that, in terms of our coastal communities, Hurricane Sandy has just revealed how vulnerable New York is. New York is very similar to New Orleans in that much of the city is below sea level. Much of New York is literally below ground, the subway, the tunnels, the parking garages, the cellars, the basements. So much of New York is below sea level. And we've seen what happens when a surge comes into lower Manhattan and comes over the banks of the Hudson and East Rivers. And there's just going to be more of that with climate change as the oceans rise and hurricanes get bigger. We have three choices, really. We can retreat from most of our coastal areas inland, and that's not anyone's preference, obviously. Number two, we can adapt and just try to endure, adapt to life in this higher seas and bigger storms. Or three, we can make a very rapid switch to non-carbon-based energy, hopefully in time to stabilize the climate. You know, we're not gonna retreat, at least not as a first course. We're probably gonna do a combination of two and three. We're going to adapt and rapidly switch to clean energy, one hopes, very soon. But in terms of adaptation, that essentially means in New York, we're gonna have to build levees. We're gonna have to build floodgates. Washington, D.C. on the Potomac is gonna need a floodgate. Baltimore on the Patapsco River, parts of Charleston. We're going to have to live behind levees just like New Orleans now. And that is a scary, terrifying prospect, but it's one that we've created for ourselves because we've been so slow to respond to the threat of global warming. So I think it's inevitable, Ian, that you're going to see and very soon, I think not long after we finally get past the humanitarian crisis phase of Sandy, you're going to see what previously would have been scarcely credible conversations about building levees in parts of New Jersey and New York, and again, a floodgate similar to what is now on the Thames River that protects London from surge tides. You're going to see that in the East Coast of the United States, and it's going to be a form of adaptation to climate change, but it's so risky. But this is what the East Coast is going to look like.
Again, Mike Tidwell, who is the director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and author of the book The Ravaging Tide, which is about global warming and hurricanes. He also has an article at The Nation. We are all from New Orleans now. Mike, this is this going to permeate, though, this reality? Is it going to permeate the last few days of this presidential debate? As we mentioned earlier, neither candidate has talked about it, although Obama did talk about it on MTV. They've clearly avoided it in their three debates. Is there any way in the last minute that either side can capitalize on it? I mean, you've got Romney today refusing to even talk about his policy of throwing FEMA back to the states. He just simply refused to comment on his own policy. Is Obama like to say something, do you think?
You know, I don't know. The three presidential debates that we watched, it's important to understand that conversation that Romney and Obama were having about energy was purchased by the fossil fuel corporations. I mean, they've given so much money to both campaigns and to politicians throughout Congress and throughout the state capitals. They've spent hundreds of millions of dollars to make sure they strike fear in the heart of anyone who really campaigns hard on climate change and tells the truth about their dirty energy, that we shouldn't be surprised that those debates were minus any reference to climate change. It's tragic. It's terrible. But again, they refuse to talk about it, but the climate has decided here at the last minute to speak to them. And again, the fingerprints of global warming are all over Sandy. Whether the president can bring, certainly Romney will never, he acknowledges that the planet is warming, but he refuses to express an opinion as to what's causing it, which is obviously ridiculous and anti-science to its core. The president, on the other hand, my guess is he's unlikely to come clean on climate change, although he's surrounded by many advisors, many of whom I know, who are telling him you need to speak more about this, and who swear to activists that the president does get it, but that the number one thing he needs to do is get reelected. They remind us constantly if Romney becomes president, he will dismantle the EPA. He will appoint at least one or two justices to the Supreme Court, and will be nowhere close to getting a price on carbon fuels for the next generation. So that's the argument that Obama's people make for being reticent on the issue of climate change, but it's not good enough. And I think that, writers and activists like Bill McKibben and others have been campaigning hard. Bill McKibben's going on a nationwide tour called Do the Math Tour that shows just how much carbon is still in the ground worldwide in oil, coal, and natural gas, and just how much carbon the fossil fuel companies intend by their own business models, their own announced design, tend to bring up and set on fire five times more than the climate can possibly tolerate. So the ExxonMobil and the coal companies and Chevron, they intend to complete the catastrophic warming of the planet. That is their intention, their public intention to do that. But if you do the math, and that's part of this nationwide tour, and you can Google it, do the math, Bill McKibben and his group 350.org, you can see Bill and myself and others who are going to be talking about this, do the math, and trying to bring this issue to whichever administration takes over after the election.
Well, just in closing, Mike Tedwell, I'm not aware that my understanding is that in 2010, the biggest donors to the Republicans when they surprised everybody and took over the House that were oil and gas. The huge investments in oil from oil and gas in 2010, orchestrated by Karl Rove and others. My understanding in this race that the 99% of the money is going to Romney, and that in coal country, Obama is being painted as the enemy of coal, even if he keep talking about clean coal, which is a myth. So I'm not aware that Obama's getting any money from oil and coal, is he? I mean, nothing like what Romney's getting.
No, the American Petroleum Institute, for example, gives an overwhelming share of its donations to the Republicans and to Mitt Romney. But they do donate to Democrats. You know, there are many polluters all over the country, coal extraction companies, utilities that are addicted to coal, that give lots of money to Democrats. So, you know, there's a reason why the Democrats, or many of the centrist Democrats, won't talk about climate change, and much of that is because they fear the money given to their opponents, and they need the money given to them by the fossil fuel companies. You know, the fossil fuel companies spread their money around, but you're right, the Republicans get a huge share of it. Chevron, the oil company Chevron, just gave $2.5 million to Romney 3 days ago, which is the largest single corporate donation given since the Citizens United decision from the Supreme Court. So that's very revealing and explains a lot about Governor Romney's position on climate change.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Mike Tedwell.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Mike Tedwell, who's the director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and the author of The Ravaging Tide, a book about global warming and hurricanes. He has an article at The Nation, We Are All New Orleans Now. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.